We'll get started. Thank you. I do have some questions submitted. Some very rude ones for... never mind, I'm kidding. Just like to... I love his reactions. They're so wonderful. So I think I'll begin with a question for Lori. Has anyone else tried gold grids, and what issues have they faced? So it's a question about using these gold grids, and I think, has anyone else tried these gold grids? Have you given them to anyone to try?
So a number of people at the LMB have tried gold grids, and they worked. They had a good experience. Amade, I think, has an experience.
But the real question is, has anybody else tried to make them?
So we have tried, and we have had one bad experience, which is that our protein dissociated, so it precipitated with... which is not quite expected because gold is supposed to be a sort of inoculus. And we partially resolved the issue by washing the gold grid in water, but you might have other ways to wash your grid. And then there was less precipitation, but still the protein was not happy and the structure looked like half sort of... It was a tetramer and half of the particles were... half dissociated, like with 3 units sort of not glued together. So it was not, but apart from that, the pictures looked very sharp. So it nice looking picture, but bad for the protein.
I mean, people have tried a number of soluble proteins and membrane proteins, and we haven't yet encountered that. But I'll be interested to hear what other people experience.
Can I add to that here? So we put gamma secretase on them, and they didn't seem to dissociate, so that seemed to be okay. What we did find was very, very important was to what Laurie mentioned about the elimination. It's absolutely crucial to eliminate the whole symmetrically. So you have to touch a bit of the gold on every part, on all around the circular hole, and take your image in the middle. So if you go a bit asymmetrically, then some of the beneficial effects get lost.
So I haven't tried gold grids is my answer to the question. But if you have to eliminate the whole hole, that significantly reduces your throughput compared to the... If you're using something like EPU and you know, taking 7 images a hole, for example, you can... You would have a much higher throughput. Is that a... Or do you find the same... Or do you have the same issue that you have to illuminate the whole hole for a quantifoil as well, in your viewpoint?
Yeah, I mean, you really notice the difference if you... So we illuminate around 200 nanometers on every side of the hole. So we use 1.2 micron holes. And as soon as your beam starts to shift and you're not completely... symmetric. You can see that the images aren't as sharp.
I had an experience with grids that were prepared in a similar fashion. So these were copper grids with carbon on top, quantifoil, coated with gold on the back or on the front. And initially I thought I saw an improvement, but then, you know, comparing batches of untreated versus treated grids, I failed to see a real improvement. So all of a sudden, you know, my grids were behaving well. The particles were not moving so much. So it's very hard to make a point when you now do not see the differences. So I don't know how much of what you're reporting is a matter of the carbon behaving bad versus the gold behaving good, or the gold behaving good because you have gold. So that's the caveat I see.
So we were very careful to always, you know, make the same grids from the same batches, make them on the same day with the same protein and the same freezing session, to as carefully as we can compare, do a direct comparison between different types of grids.
So I was interested in when you showed the different regimes of the movement, that you still have a fast and a slow movement. And to me, that these two different regimes suggest that sort of two different, possibly two different courses to this. And the fact that you still see this suggests to me that the underlying reason for this hasn't been solved necessarily, but it has been made sort of suppressed a little more. Is it possible that part of the improvement comes from the gold just being a little more rigid? I mean, you offered some, you know, explanations or possible explanations for this improvement, and I was wondering if maybe this is just a matter of more mechanical stability.
So I think the AFM measurements, where we press the tip into the actual grid, show that the flexural rigidity of the gold is less. So the mechanical stability, or the flexural rigidity is less.
So what exactly, in terms of mechanical property, are you testing there? I'm not so sure.
So you press the tip into the membrane, and you measure. You model that,
so that
the
would
pressure
be
as a spring,
mm-hmm.
And so basically it's the
but
carbon
in terms
is
of,
stronger.
X Y pull push. You know, I'm not even sure which part of the rigidity matters. You know, is it bending? Is it elasticity? At this point.
Microphone, please.
Sorry. When you did that with the AFM, that was not in cryo, was it? So
that was at room temperature, yeah.
Yeah, so the behavior of the carbon might be very different.
It may be different, No, we can't exclude that. But yeah, also the two phases of motion. I think, you know, the second phase is almost gone with the gold. And so we don't know, but we'd like to think of it that the second phase of motion may be mostly due to the substrate, due to the grid, but the first phase may be motion of the ice itself, or the particles within the ice. But of course, we don't know yet. That's just a hypothesis.
Yeah, to have a fair comparison, wouldn't be necessary to compare the same thickness of carbon to the same thickness of gold. You mentioned that when you tried thinner gold, you saw some movement. So, and the typical thickness of quantifiable carbon is maybe around 20 nanometers or so. And you use 40 to 50 nanometers of gold, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I think,
I mean, have you tried evaporating more carbon on quantifoil to see if that will improve the result?
We haven't tried.
All right.
But I thought Bob tried that, Bob and Ken.
Richard, yeah.
Oh, sorry, okay. And what did you find?
I think what you're referring to is the paper I did together with Richard on paraffin crystals on 400 angstrom thick carbon, and we got perfect images. There was the diffraction spots at 4 angstroms of paraffin were exactly what they should be, you know, based on what the electron diffraction amplitudes were.
Why doesn't everybody use 400 angstrom thick carbon?
Well, what I have against adding carbon to a pre-existing quantifoil or C-flat is after you have deposited a layer of carbon, vent it to air and evaporate another one, that second layer does not adhere well. It's slippery. So when the carbon film is made for a holy carbon film, if it were made in 300 or 400, my guess is that it'd be probably as good as gold. Lori made a really good point, is that if it's made out of a single element, you know, a single material, gold, then the thermal expansion coefficient, and it'll avoid cryo crinkling. We used to put you know, carbon on molybdenum to avoid cryocrinkling. So I think that's a really good part of I have a question. Can I ask a question? Do you, once you make the gold holy gold on gold grids, do you glow discharge it before use?
Yeah, we do. We treat it just like a...
And is the gold membrane hydrophilic? I guess you can't tell because it's too electron opaque. You can't really see through it. So I'm wondering whether there really is water over the gold or if it's the cartoon that you drew where the water is confined only to the hole and it's dry over the gold. Do you know?
That's a good question. I think we never see any kind of doming of the ice over the... So if you have thick ice, you can have really thick ice.
Yes.
So we can see that. So it's...
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think there's ice over top of the gold.
Yeah. And thin carbon films, you know, you might think there's only water in the hole, but if you burn a little while on the carbon, you always have water over there.
Hmm.
So it's not the way people draw the cartoons, that they would like the water to be only in the hole and the rest to be dry, but it's not that way.
So I have a question. So, I mean, gold has the advantage that you can buy gold grids and put gold on them, so the whole thing is made of gold. But should you, or have you thought about other things that might work better? Can you make a grid that's entirely molybdenum, for example, or, you know, why gold?
I mean, we chose gold because it's conductive and it has a high generation of secondary electrons when you irradiate it, so we thought that might help mitigate charging effects. And it's used in lots of biological devices, so it's biocompatible. That's not to say that other metals wouldn't work, but it was just easy for us to try. We haven't tried any other ones.
Okay. Thank you. So I have another question about the whole cell lysate on a grid. So have you tried antibody labeling to pinpoint proteins of interest that may not be so recognizable as your filaments?
Yes, we've tried that. So there's different ways to do that. One way is doing this inline purification. We can purify a protein using an antibody and then in that moment add a secondary antibody that has a gold label on it to label a binding partner, for example. We can then also use any mouse antibodies and then use anti-mouse gold-labeled antibodies. And so, yeah, we have done all that. So inline purification with additional labeling and also on the grid labeling. But you have to know what you're looking for. And this was also in the frame of a systems biology project where we did not know what to look for. Yeah, and so we wanted to go for the general method in the first place.
So one of the interesting things in doing proteomics on a single cell would be to be able to count the number of a particular structure. I know you have losses. Do you have some way of getting an accurate count by doping with in some way or doing something like mass spec people do?
That was actually the target of a PhD thesis, which is finished and the paper is submitted, Dominique Gitz et al., where he just made dilution series and put the sample on a grid and then counted particles using Legendron on a T12, recording 5,000 pictures automatically and having the Appian pipeline measure quantities of particles. And that came out wonderfully linear over a huge dynamic range. And we verified this with this reverse proteomics array that uses fluorescence to measure quantities. We also could even measure binding curves of proteins binding to antibodies or other ligands. So negative stain can become very linear. If you do adsorption and blotting, then different proteins behave differently. In the writing, where we have less nonspecific loss, it can become a quantitative method. Yeah, so this is one of the things. In a normal cell, from some proteins, we have very few copies, 10 or 100 or so. On average, I think a few hundred proteins only per cell. So you don't have much flexibility to lose proteins on the way. That's what we try to develop there.
When you have such a low copy number, entities, did you actually manage to find them, like 10 or 100 copies of a particular protein?
So far, we only looked for the large things that are obvious. So we did not look for the needle in the haystack yet. Yeah, so actin and GROWELs, and so these you can all find, proteasomes and so on.
How about a centriole?
We have not seen one, as far as I know.
I have another question here. Can you elaborate on the piezo brush, the reproducibility, ease of use, cost, etc.?
Of this writing thing? I keep encouraging, I think it's the same for you, I keep encouraging Thomas Brown to pick one of his students and found a startup.
We have one in the lab right now, if people want to try it out. There's one in our lab.
John's volunteer. At the poster session, I think if you come to our lab, John will show you the piezo brush.
Oh, the piezo brush. Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah.
That's, sorry.
Yeah, so how much is it? How reproducible? How easy?
No idea.
We've had it for a week.
I think $4,000 or something in that order of magnitude. It's not that expensive compared to a Lotus charger.
We have one because they loaned us one for exactly 1 week. I think it has to go back at the end of this week.
But I think the cost was more like... Is
$5,000?
No. It was more like $5,000 or something like that.
Yeah. But I mean, how much is a glow discharger?
An easy glow, I know, I just bought one. It's like 6,000.
I think it's 6,000 or 7,000. Felix, do you remember?
A glow discharger.
Yeah, a glow discharger. And then, you know, it's bulky. And I thought it was awesome. Choo! If this works, I would have bought that.
Also, there's less delay between your plasma cleaner and your grid.
Yeah. Just a quick side question. What's the original purpose of the plasma brush? What's the original purpose of this device? Was it designed to be like a glow discharger, or was it made for some other
applications? I think it's for cleaning and wound activation, so you accelerate healing and for sterilizing things in the hospital, and it's a little Swiss company as far as I know.
Like a medical application. Okay.
In the lab in a minute, okay? Just come at the post.
we cut them out. So I think Ivan had some preliminary results I didn't show, actually using the piezo brush, that it sort of was doing the same kind of job in terms of spreading drops as the as our plasma cleaner. I mean, this is a week or two of using the thing.
Oops, there. So there were a couple of questions for Elizabeth. How easy is it when you have a milled cell? Don't you have to get the tilt axis right perpendicular to the milled slot?
Yes.
And how easy is that to do?
So we...
How do you do it?
You have, for the grids that have a slot, you can visually orient it, and you get it. You get relatively good at it. If you have a Titan, of course, you just grab it with a tweezer, you see the peephole, you put them in the... And if you mess up, you can still wiggle it around. So in a Titan, it's flawless, basically. For the Polara, we have modified Polara cartridges I didn't talk about. And generally what we do is we put the autogrid with the flat side down, so you have better thermal contact, so it's actually harder to orient. So we just use a Sharpie. Like before, before we actually used two color Sharpies, so it's easy to say. So you just mark it, and it's easy. So generally, unless you get it completely wrong, which happens because you got confused on how it went, it's relatively easy to do. But yeah, then again, I was saying that with relatively simple, I would say, software changes, you could compensate for these things or try to do dual tilt in a relatively successful way. But the acquisition has to be modified a little bit.
You know, you're too quiet out there. Do I have to ask all the questions? There's a question right there. Good. We bullied somebody into.
So, as you said in your talk, what you really want to be able to do is target. And you need to be able to do that then in 3D. And you need to be able to target in three dimensions, I guess. And you need to get your object into a lamella of 100 or 200 nanometers.
Right.
So how do you even begin to go there?
So, I mean, in topography, all conceptually everything is very simple, right? It's the implementation that kills you. But if you can do stuff with some level of accuracy in C, like a confocal, it's just a coordinate transformation, right? So you can put whatever you do in 3D, I mean, for light microscopy, whatever you do in 3D, you just have to change the reference frame to superimpose it in the focus ion beam. And I think that, you know, all of us software geeks like doing these things, but the MAPS software is also moving forward in this direction. Whether you're going to get it right or not, it's something that I'm not so sure. But as I showed today, actually, I think that there'll be a chance to guide it just with cryo-SEM contrast. So, of course, not if you have very small things, but at least you can be guided for large things if that helps. So it's not going to be trivial. The devil is always in the details, but I think that you'll have a higher chance. Another possibility is just to, you know, make a bunch of lamella and then do your cryo-correlative after and then just see if you hit some nice spots. So for you and I who like yeast, this is, I think, statistically completely doable. For other things, it's a little bit more painful, I guess. Then there's a lot of talk about actually putting like a rastering laser, like a scanning laser microscope inside a dual beam chamber. And there's really no reason not to do that. So that would be very helpful because you can do it on the fly as you're milling.
I'll just start. This question is for Clint. It would be great to have a freezing device where instead of setting a blotting time, you set the ice thickness. What are the prospects for a device that measures the thickness of the film of water on a grid and has a feedback loop so that it plunges when the thickness hits the right point?
Could you just repeat? I have a hard time hearing one more time.
So a freezing device that measures the film thickness and freezes the grid when the water thickness is the right amount.
I think it's very possible. I mean, I showed those fringes. We've done a lot more fringe analysis with John Marone. He did a sabbatical here. And we showed that I believe that is totally possible. You can analyze those fringes with a video camera and get an idea when the thickness is. And if you know the delay, I think it's possible. But you need really the camera to do it and on all this other instrumentation.
That would be very useful.
Yeah, I think so too.
Our advisory committee said we have to do that.
So I have a question here, I think for Tom, but maybe for the whole panel. So somebody asked, has anyone tried cryo-negative stain for cryo-electron tomography?
Anyone out there?
Anyone tried it?
I don't have anything to add to that. We've done negative stain for very big things in tomography, but not cryo. I mean, Andreas tried that, but that was, you know, it was kind of a one-off thing, and, you know, it was, who knows. With a K2, life would be very different, right, so in terms of the analysis.
So when we did random conical tilt of cryo-negative stain samples when I was in Tom's lab, one of the problems that we always ran into is on the second image, you'd often start to see bubbling of the stain. So I think that would really inhibit you to be able to do that for tomography.
Would you look forward to go down those tomography?
But it was still accumulating. I don't know. I I think it would be really
probably
hard.
Go down by the dose.
So I've actually done cryonegative stain of apoferritin, and that worked quite nicely. You could go to quite high dose. Just to
I have a question for Henning going, on the single cell lysate once you've written it onto a grid. How long do you envisage with the current, with the existing stages and stuff, it would take to image it at sufficient magnification to get everything in there, image the whole cell?
We use Legendon and we just switch it on for, I don't know, a few days. It's on a T12, it just... I don't know what fraction of grids we image, but...
Don't you need to be an order of magnitude faster at least to be able to do this, to get sort of quantitative measurements over several cells? And
so I think Dominic imaged 5,000, took 5,000 pictures per sample, times 5, so 25 per grid, 25,000 images per grid that were automatically evaluated and counted for particles and lengths of filaments and so on.
But do you really need to image every single thing? You just need to get ratios of things, maybe, unless you're looking for centrioles.
You're missing the grid bars anyway, right? So you cannot get everything, but you can get maybe 10% or so.
I have a question for everybody. with this capability of putting multiple samples on a grid so you could explore conditions the way crystallographers do. With the kit, there's a kit you can buy and it tells you exactly what crystallization conditions to set up. So if I'm a beginning graduate student and I want to try this out for my sample, what advice of conditions would you have me try with one of these spotted on? What sorts of things would I vary?
For 3D crystallization?
In order to find good conditions to get good images, what sorts of things should people think about varying? And just pick up some...
Well, I mean, certainly look at different concentrations for particle density, that kind of thing. Maybe different buffers, what's aggregating or not. Look at maybe, is there a detergent, different detergents for membrane proteins, all those sorts of things I think you could probably do. But I think if you wanted, that kit you wanted would have to target the specific sort of protein you're looking at, I think.
But this is a big space to explore, so where would you start? Suppose we know what buffer conditions the thing is stable at, so that's not really the question. Which detergents would you try?
Well, I mean, I think for the membrane proteins, I think the MMG detergents, those sorts of things, we've had pretty good luck with.
I was gonna unfairly just point that question at Holger. Sorry, Holger. because, I mean, you were looking into this, looking at multiple parameters and trying to work out using relatively rapid assays which would be most promising for structure determination. And I guess the question is, what are those axes that you would recommend varying?
So what we see is that pH is completely underestimated, so the effect of pH on complex stability and aggregation is enormous. And what we also see is that the pH that we see for many different complexes covers a really much broader range than we currently see in the EMDB database, where everything is focused on pH 7 and 7.5. So it's we see a much broader range, and it very much fits to the distribution that you find in the PDB data for whatever people have done in crystallography, so that it's also a very broad range of pH values. The second most important thing to test is the buffer substance itself. So different buffers have sometimes really destabilizing or very stabilizing effects. And then all sorts of small molecules that you may add and may bind or interact with your complexes that may stabilize. So this is the kind of screening we are doing.
So how many conditions is
that? This is in a 96 well blade, and how many conditions is that? We have, how many, David?
Three different screens.
Three different screens?
300.
300, okay. Yeah, it's not. I mean, yeah, it's not so much concerned about how you prepare your crypt. It's more about how you keep how to keep your complexes intact and prevent them from aggregation and these kind of things.
Tom,
can I have? Can I comment on that, please? Our lab has developed a 96 well procedure for screening proteomic conditions for extracting endogenous complexes from cells. And we were pretty successful in it, and our paper is now in press, so if you want to come visit my poster, I will tell you how we do it.
Great. Tom, you had a question?
So I was actually serious about this question. Who is thinking about doing in situ electron microscopy and why? I would actually really like to understand that. So where you put the sample in solution and put the liquid into the microscope. Not tomography. But
we can't hear you.
Hit it harder.
So, wow. And the premise was to see things happening in real time, like a very HIV maturation. If I could see HIV maturing while I'm looking at it, that would be great. And but the SNR that I got was so low, and the doses that I had to use was so high that I couldn't do anything with it. There is also another thing that, in principle, that control, at least the stage that I got, was that the control theoretically should be done by changing the solution conditions, but if a person that do a simple rheological calculation would understand actually that you, when you try to change, you get this small capillary that you change the liquid inside the cell, the liquid would never go between the two windows. It just goes around them. So it won't work for such things like dynamics.
So I once thought about such experiments also until I discussed with Bob Glaser about it, and he explained me things about gray and life under extremely high radiation, and that changed my mind, and then I didn't consider it further. And maybe, Bob, you could further explain what your opinion is on liquid electron microscopy and looking with the electron beam at a drop of water and trying to see individual molecules at work.
As Dieter Tipke, who worked with me, famously said at one time, I know the answer, but I'm not going to tell you. And the reason is it would take too many hours to explain it, but you said it all. It's radiation damage, and then to get into more detail, I think becomes a one-hour lecture or something.
Can you do 5 minutes? Do you think, do you think there is any prospect at any point? Because I really don't see any point.
I agree with you completely. The 5-minute answer, or maybe the 50-second answer. The electron doses that we use in cryo, it depends on what resolution you want to get, but the doses we use in cryo are, let's say, 30 electrons per square angstrom or 100 electrons per square angstrom. It corresponds to a radiation dose that a radiation chemist would talk about, 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10 rads. Enzymes are pretty much inactivated at 10 to the 6 rads. So if we take the worst case scenario, 10 to the 10 versus 10 to the 6, four orders of magnitude, that if you take one image and then take another one, you can be sure that whatever movement you saw between the first and the second is not due to enzyme catalysis.
And thank so, you.
Yeah.
Just a comment on that. I think there's a group out of Virginia Tech, Deborah Kelly, who's doing some liquid in situ TEM using silicon nitride windows to kind of utilize the K2 camera and the movie processing to study structural dynamics. I haven't read the papers, but I know that she's doing that.
Rather than just freeze it. I mean, why would you do it if you have an asynchronous process? I think just taking a lot of images and then classifying it, you actually can give the dose, you don't see the beam damage. And what Bob said, I mean, you have it for one exposure and everything is dead, so what are you going to learn? So the idea is not new. People have tried to do this for a long time, and okay, you can now make holders where you can actually put the stuff into the microscope. What do you learn?
When we asked for, we solicited ideas for this meeting, Bob forbade us to discuss this topic, so probably should move on.
I have a question about cleaning grids. Most people clean grids or just use them right out of the box for the quantifoils or C-flats.
So I wash grids in ethylene acetate instead of glow discharging. That makes them semi-hydrophilic, semi-hydrophobic, and gives you a medium-sized water layer, but other people prefer glow discharging, so then...
So we just use a plasma cleaner. I think it's an argon-oxygen mix most of the time, is that right?
Is something left of the grid after that?
Oh, yeah.
There's another way I heard about it, is that you wash it with chloroform and soak in the chloroform for a long time, and then you don't close it, but then you put it in a vacuum, not vacuum cleaner, but you put it in the evaporator, just pump it, and then once it's dry, then use it directly.
But do you use it?
I saw other people use it, get a really good result.
So I had a question about this cleaning business with glow discharge. I thought of that question when I listened to Lori's talk, because she said that she can make gold grids hydrophilic in the glow discharge. You know, with other material, maybe there's some dangling bonds at the end and so on, but with gold, I wasn't so sure. And so I wonder if anybody knows what exactly is happening doing glow discharging. I know that it depends very much on the atmospheric conditions, whether you actually deposit something during that discharge or take some stuff off. And well, maybe that's the reason why the gold grids, for example, become more hydrophilic. Does anybody know anything about this?
I mean, we switched to mostly using the plasma instead of glow discharging because it's more reproducible. You can control the gas mixtures in there, and that works the same. So it also makes the gold grids hydrophilic enough to use. But I don't understand what's happening.
Henning, over here again. Can you expand on that? Because that's an awful lot cheaper than buying a plasma cleaner. How reliable and reproducible is it?
I don't really know. You would have to ask Thomas Bonner about that. There was a master's student, Simon Scheuring, who's now an AFM professor in Marseille, and in his master thesis, he did AFM on glow-discharged mica. And he measured voltages. You must have also been there also. He measured voltages of glow discharges and times, and then looked at it with the AFM. And with the AFM, he looked at the surface and then also scratched a hole down to the mica and looked at the thickness of the layer. And there was a growing grease layer or something on the grids that got thicker and thicker and thicker and then became bumpy at one point. Yeah, and he could always dive down, and then he came up with some glow discharging parameters that he thought make a very thin and smooth dirt layer on it. So 15 years ago.
But you just wash your grids and don't glow discharge.
Yeah, but I rarely do it myself.
And your lab haven't caught on to this idea, or?
No. They glow discharge.
So this has to do with the gold grids. So I noticed in your presentation that all the ice was really nice from slide to slide, and so that made it possible for you to do comparisons. And I'm assuming one person did this, and I just was curious about getting reproducible ice with the gold grids, if it's easier, because we tend to have issues where we just assume 3 out of 4 grids is going to be crappy ice, or they're going to be all broken holes or something, and I'm trying to convince my boss to do this gold thing, and I need a good reason, so.
I mean, so we always inspect all the grids using an optical microscope before we use them, gold grids, carbon grids, all of them, just to make sure there's not lots of broken squares, so we avoid wasting time doing that. And then I think just by being very reproducible, we switched to using a plasma chamber instead of using glow discharge. We found that was more reproducible. And we use a Vitrobot for making our grids, so we use the same Vitrobot all the time with the same settings, and the ice thickness seems to be fairly reproducible, both on the carbon and on gold.
What generation of Vitrobot?
We have... We have both, and we've used both.
And they both work really well.
Yeah, with different settings.
So I have a question actually for Tom to expand on contamination. So what kind of contamination can come out of the ethane? What kind of contamination can come out of the ethane? Is there a contamination on cryogrids that can come from dirty ethane or the ethane propane or so. Yeah. In liquid nitrogen, we have ice balls that are micrometer sized, but in our lab, we suffer from little like raindrops on the grids, and we don't really know where these come from. And one hypothesis is ethane, but Radu also said something very interesting on that. So.
Yeah, I also have a question about the ethane. I would like to know what people is using in terms of the grade of purity. So is 5 people what is using, or 3? 5 is more expensive, so I wonder if that's justify the extra cost, because then maybe you run less into contamination, maybe due to ethane.
We generally use 5, but it's more has to do with, as you get the tank gets more and more empty, there's crud that's on the bottom. Or if you're like, you know, have jostled the tank a bit, the oils and stuff, you know, from when they fill it, if they didn't clean it correctly, sometimes get spit out onto your, you know, with the ethane. So that's probably what you're seeing. I don't think ethane would itself be a contaminant, but maybe that the oils are things that are in the ethane. I don't think anybody's done any analysis of exactly what these small little things, we see them once in a while, but you can minimize them by using a full tank or, you know, not moving around the tank very much. We haven't tried a filter, but that could possibly help.
I have a question, but I'm going to change the subject. So if you want to say something about this, then keep going.
It's related. Surprisingly often, we've seen little droplets from contamination from carbon evaporators. And I think Anders Lessinger has also seen that, where something's wrong with the vacuum system of the evaporate and you actually get some oil contamination in the chamber.
I have a question.
Just
about
a short comment about the ethane. In Japan, we had a severe problem with this contamination. The easy way to tell it is not water, it's not crystalline. You see these kind of black blobs on the surface, and they're usually round, and they disappear very quickly when you put the beam on them. So the way to solve it for us was not, we bought the very pure one, it didn't solve it, so we just blot off the ethane after transferring to the nitrogen, but this kind of solved the issue.
What about the ones that look like dust bunnies? Don't people say that that's also ethane contamination? You know, like the...
Yeah, sometimes they look kind of webby on the surface of the ice, and obviously they are not water crystals because, you know...
So I just saw some of that on top of a lamella the other day, and it can't be ethane, right? So...
When you freeze the grids, then if you have a little bit of ethane left on the grids, look like a little bit white ethane. Mm-hmm. Those things will evaporate immediately once it goes to vacuum, so it will not sustain. So what do you see if in the grids is not the ethane? And then because the ethane, unless there's some dirty things which is in the ethane tank which get into the grids, that's a different thing, that's not ethane. And ethane by itself is a... So what a problem with those little droplets that you have left on the grids if it's ethane is that it could crash your vacuum. So sometimes you put in the grids into the vacuum, then it crashes immediately because that little piece of ethane, once it gets into the high vacuum, it only evaporates once in the certain high vacuum. The pre-chamber will not be able enough to pump it out. Once it goes to the high vacuum, then it will be evaporated right away, and then that will crash your vacuum. So in the Joe microscope, so this Yoshi type, this microscope, there's a pre-chamber is pumped by a diffusion pump. And then or by the higher vacuum pump, then there you can see the ethane actually vapor there. So once you get it to the microscope, it's no problem. So ethane is not the contaminant, whatever it is, which I don't know, but it's for sure it's not ethane.
I was going to ask a different question.
Final comment. So ethane is not 100% pure, so when it sublimates into the vacuum, whatever heavier fractions, hydrocarbons are there, they get deposited on the surface of the grid. That's my opinion. So ethane is not 100% pure, and when it sublimates into the vacuum, the heavier fractions, they get deposited like these kind of webby things. Yeah, yep.
Okay. So Bridget's now heard enough about ethane. I had a question about single particle of membrane protein. So there's a lot of this going on now, and people are using, people are putting them in detergent, they're putting them in amphipoles, in nanodiscs, and so on. So does anybody want to speculate about the pros and cons or whether there's going to be something else coming in the future? Is there a best approach? I guess that's for Tom or Henning or...
No, I think every protein needs something else, unfortunately. That's my experience. Yifan maybe can also answer that. So which fraction of proteins works under the conditions that were so successful for you? So amphipoles. Which fraction of proteins works in amphipoles as single particles?
And you can just get
a microphone. Who's got the microphone? Oh, sorry. So an amphipole, like A5-38, this one, the one we used in the chip channel, works very well for chip channel. But for other membrane protein, this may not be a good one. And I'll actually try to, there's a few other ones that this actually break the complex. And then there are a number of different amphipoles, and all called a different name, but you can look at the list. My suggestion is try all of them, see which one works. I have no idea which one works. And then similar for detergent, some actually, DDM, like in the ABC transporter case, the DDM works pretty well. And then in some other case, that like MNG3 works better. So I don't think there is for us, that I just want to try everything that what is possible. But on the other hand, it would be best still, I mean, Tom and Honey might agree that still the best thing is in the lipid, in the membrane. So that if nanodisc works, that probably is better than any other things. That's my guess.
Well, not for high resolution. I don't think nanodisc is the solution. I'm interested because of lipid-protein interactions, but nanodisc will introduce a lot of heterogeneity, and that's what we are fighting with. And in terms of amphipoles, they never work for us, unfortunately. We were very excited about it, and for our membrane proteins, not ours, but collaborators, detergent works better for some reason. But we only tried one, so how many different amphipoles are there?
At least there are like four or five, three or four, I don't remember what's the exact number.
And they differ in what aspect?
You got me, they're different in certain ways.
I see.
So we talked a little about the freezing of grids, and you, Tom, I think made the point that for a while you didn't get good ice with a certain plunger and thought it had to do with the distance traveled, and if I understand it correctly, the distance was too short, therefore the speed at which it would hit the ethane wasn't high enough. So there's a paper, unfortunately I don't know the authors, but there's a paper that describes high-speed photography or video of a grid entering liquid ethane, and it's I think they describe that actually there's a parting of the ethane and that the cooling happens from the rim of the grid. Anyway, it's probably, you know, it's just one study, but I actually wonder if anybody understands in a little more detail how these grids actually freeze. I mean, I guess the image that you were promoting is that the quicker you get the grid into the ethane, the more uniform it freezes. Whereas the other study says it freezes from one side anyway, and therefore it shouldn't matter so much how quickly it enters. Anyway.
I had no idea.
That paper, too, I think suggested the grid should land flat on its face on the ethane, not go in edgeways, and that it would freeze much faster that way.
But then you can't use the grid anymore because it crumbled it.
But I think they showed that it sustained that.
Which paper is this?
I can't remember either.
It's 2 minutes.
So what did they come up with? How do you freeze? No, I mean, every commercial, every plunger I've ever seen has the same setup. So if this is not an ideal setup, we should talk to FEI and Gatan.
In X-ray crystallography, it's very common to do selenomethionine labeling. I'm wondering if there's anything equivalent that to label amino acids that then would be dense in the cryo-EM situation.
Sorry. Can you say it? I didn't get the full question. What do you want to label?
Is there a way to label the a specific amino acid in cryo-EM? For example, selenomethionine shows up very well in X-ray crystallography, and it allows to mark a specific residue in the X-ray diffraction. I'm pretty naive. Maybe somebody's doing this. Yeah.
No, I don't think so that we have these labels that are. Yeah, but not for single. I mean.
Yeah.
We.
I think he said the idea is to use this one as a market for model building. Is that right?
Yeah,
not for the image alignment.
Okay, the session's almost over. We have time for one really important question. Or one not so important question, or just some question, but just probably the last one.
It's a question for Tom. Do you have any idea when this leopard skin contamination forms and how to deal with it? Because we've been struggling with this for quite some time.
The leopard skin?
Yeah.
No, I wanted to discuss it because I don't know either. what I do think is that what a lot of people seem to think is that it doesn't happen when you freeze. It happens afterwards at some point. And so it's not really inside of the ice, it's something on top of the ice.
Yeah. Yeah, the question is...
I don't do tomograms.
Do you ever get it on...
You did a tomogram and the ice is outside? What does leopard ice look like?
Ugly?
We did it together.
Yes. So, I don't have an... it's extremely thin. I couldn't tell. If you look at the slice, whether you have bad SNR on the tomogram, you don't see any difference. But when you sum the images, like when you look through the projection, you can see it. And even already when you do the tilt series, you can see that it moves with the stuff that is on the top on the bottom. You don't even have to reconstruct. You can see that it's like some wavy, ugly thing on the top on the bottom.
You can see it only with the turtles or with everything?
No. This is with everyone for the monomer. And it's with eyes that is as thin as 10 nanometers, held by the 10 nanometer gold. And the layer is much thinner than that, so low 2 nanometers. So that's all.
Can that be?
Bob must have a really important question.
So when many times when we see the leopard skin ice, we take a picture, 20 electrons per square angstrom, and take a second one, it's gone on the second one. Mm-hmm. People generally have that experience? Yeah. So I think that says it has to be on the surface, but it's not proof.
Okay.
Sorry, I don't remember. I have to go back to the tomogram and check.
I can tell you that from the experience in tomography...
No, wait. Don't make the same mistake.
The two surfaces of the tomogram are not equivalent, and in many cases the gold tend to flow to one surface and more to one than the other one. Now, I haven't taken the work of actually defining whether that's the back of the grid or the front of the grid. And the other thing is that the kind of leopard skin I'm referring to is the one that appears when the sample is in the microscope, and it's particularly, appears at the end of the session of several tomograms through a few days, and probably more often when you have a lot of tilting, because then your O-rings are letting some air go through and you get contamination. So,
okay. I think from our experience here at Scripps, we have seen it in F20s. We have not seen it in Aquarius, or in fact in the Talos. So we thought it might be vacuum related or something like that. You have? Okay, sorry. I take that back. And the Krios? Okay, ignore that whole statement.
Well, was that the last question? Just checking. I mean, that's the boss. I think I'd like you to thank the panel and to thank yourselves for answering and asking questions. Thank you.
So grab yourself a glass of wine or a beer or a soda and head for the poster session, and we'll top your glasses up while you're chatting over there.